Is Ian Dancer. Dance, if you don't mind.
That's all right, mate. Everyone calls me Dance, apart from my mum.
Local broadcaster, musician, TV star, personality. We could go through the list infinitely, but we'll get to that. So, could we start with you just giving us a little bit of an introduction for those that don't know you?
Well, I'm a radio broadcaster, national radio broadcaster. I've been working for TalkSport now for 20 years. Started as a reporter there in 2004 and became a show presenter and also a commentator. I do more commentaries than anything else there now. Been to several World Cups and European Championships. Also commentating on cricket and darts and things like that. I also currently work for Planet Rock as a presenter of my own show on there, playing sort of classic rock stuff. I started out at BRNB in my broadcasting career, at the back end of the 90s. I was the flying eye. I was the stadium announcer here for about 18 months at Birmingham City, which was an incredibly proud moment as a Blue Nose to do that job. It's been a strange old ride.
Well, normally,
to get to where I am now.
We feel like we grew up,
yeah.
I've listened to messages around Birmingham and BRNB, and it's just been our childhood and adulthood, and we've kind of.
You were the flying eye. You were the flying eye as I left school and into my first job, so literally, you're on the radio every morning. We'll get to that. Pace myself.
We can go too far too quick.
So what we normally do when we're talking to people about the jobs that they ended up with and their occupations, it always normally is people leave school, do something, and then they get kind of a yearning that they want to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
But you're a little bit different, aren't you, in that you seem to have left school, you've got a job, you're working in retail initially within music.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got, your family were all musicians, weren't they?
Yes.
So you were, did you know straight away what you wanted to do?
I had delusions of grandeur from the age of, wasn't quite as early as 10, but certainly by the time I was a teenager, I thought I was going to be a rock star. I have two older brothers, and I grew up, when I was a little lad, they had albums by bands like Thin Lizzy and Deep Purple and Running Bow in the house. I would listen to those and really like them. And then my brother said, go off and like something, you can't like what we like. I was being the irritating little brother. So I went around to my cousin's house. I would have been 9 or 10 years of age at this point. My cousin lived just around the corner from our house in Solihull. Went round there. I said, come have a look through your record collection. Flipped through. I found this Kiss album called Kiss Alive, which was a live album from 1975. I took it home. I put it on. And the first 5 songs on side 1, tracks 1 to 5, no exaggeration to say that was a life-changing moment, hearing that music and just what is this, is I love this, the energy, the drive, the sonics of it. And then you look at the band and the glam of it all with the costumes and the makeup and the flash bombs and everything. So I'd have been around 9 or 10 around that time.
That would have been quite inappropriate as well, wouldn't it?
Well,
you know, understand it's all quite, it's most of Kiss's stuff lies around sex and.
Well, it was, yes, but then as a 9 or 10 year old, you don't know that. When Paul Stanley sings, put your hand in my pocket, grab onto my rocket, you don't know what he's talking about. You don't. As a maybe 10 year olds nowadays are probably a bit more worldly wise, but I can't say that I was. So by the time I was getting into my teens, become a drummer at the age of about 10 or 11 as well. And I've been playing piano because my dad, you mentioned, come from a family of musicians. My dad was an incredible piano player, you know, sort of played all sort of lounge stuff and Gershwin and Duke Ellington. He could, you know, anything. He was amazing. So there was a musical sort of genealogy to the Danza family. But I think I decided, right, I'm going to be a rock star. I'm going to get in a band and I'm going to get famous, because the music I was into, not just Kiss, but all the other bands, the rock bands I loved around that time, just drew me into the idea of being a touring musician and going out there and making albums and things like that. And so I formed my first band at school, didn't really come to much, then formed another band with a school friend and a guy who's still my best mate to this day, Keith Lorentz, who also used to work here as a tannoy announcer. And from the age of, what would that be, I was 16, 17, so for the next 10 or 11 years, I was so single-minded about wanting to make it. And so the jobs that I had once I left college were kind of a means to an end, really. Went to Lloyds Bank, first of all. My first job was at Lloyds Bank in Shirley.
Yeah.
Worked there for a year. Then you mentioned retail. I started working for a small music shop in Shirley called Express Music, which was the other end of Shirley High Street from where Lloyds is.
Yeah.
Worked there for a couple of years. And then in the 90s, I got a job at the biggest guitar shop in Europe, Musical Exchanges, because I learned how to play guitar by this point as well, by working at the music shop. So I've become a bit of a multi-instrumentalist. But that was all a means to an end. Even working somewhere as big as Musical Exchanges in Stowe Hill, which was a fantastic place to work. But
still there, isn't it?
No, unfortunately, it's not. It's gone.
I thought it was the big one.
There was one called Sound Control that took over from it, it's gone. Don't look for it. It's not there anymore, as the man said in Spinal Tap. So, brilliant laughs and networked and met so many brilliant people working in a guitar shop. You can imagine, you're a musician, you want to make it, you're working in a guitar shop. Day after day after day, you're meeting like-minded people, you're breaking bread with people who have exactly the same ambitions that you do, not necessarily the same genre, but they want to make a success of being a musician.
Yeah.
And that drives you on. And I was in a local band here called Shotgun Wedding for about 6 years, through to 94. We did well around here, but we never progressed up that rung of the ladder. Then I joined a band who were based in South Wales. I'm still living here. They were called, they eventually called themselves Sons of God. And we did get a record deal with the Birmingham Records, which didn't come to anything. But
how frustrating was that?
Frustrating in the sense, Chuck and Winnie deserved better, and Sons of God deserved way better. I mean, I came into that situation, and the singer and the guitarist in that band were fantastic songwriters. Well, I could write songs pretty well at that point as well. I thought, well, I've hit the motherlode here. I've got a really good bunch of musicians who can all write songs. I'm being forced to better myself to get up to their level. So when this record label, MGL, that was run by Tony Sylvester, who used to have connections to Duran Duran, it was part of their management team, they offered us a record contract and, signed it at the Hyatt, actually, cigars and goodness knows what when we celebrated. But the money never came through, and it was just, it was like a slow release of a balloon, the sort of the deflation of the dream. And it got to a point of about mid-1997, when we all had a meeting and we just, it's not happening.
Let's call it down.
Yeah. And that kind of moments of clarity, alcoholics call it, isn't it? So there's a musician's moment of clarity as well when you get to a certain age in your life. So at that point, I would have been 28, 29 years of age and realising I'm not going to make it. That dream I had from when I was 11, 12 years of age, it's not going to happen. Now, I wasn't mortified by that because, all right, I hadn't made it, but I had had such fun trying to make it. That it had been such a brilliant path to be on.
Yeah.
And meeting and still being friends with now some wonderful musicians and associates and things like that wouldn't change it for the world. But it did mean that at the end of 1997, I was a bit of a crossroads as to what I wanted to do with my life. Because by then, I was working as a guitar distributor in the Black Country. I was working for Laney over in Cradley Heath, distributing guitars to shops like the one I used to work at. So there had been a slight change in my working life. And I wasn't enjoying it. It was a very lonely job, actually, compared to the camaraderie you get from working in a guitar shop with loads of other people. It was a bit different. And then, courtesy of Keith.
That's when your timeline then.
Everything the trajectory suddenly, the handbrake turn occurred in.
So how did that come about? So for the record, so this is, you were doing impressions for friends and family.
Yes.
And then your friend has then sent a tape of you.
Well, no, he didn't even send a tape. So I was still working at Musical Exchanges at the time. So this is early 1997. And Keith Laurent had sent a letter to Tom Ross at BR&B saying, my mate Ian, he does impressions of Trevor Francis and Graham Taylor and Des Lynam and Alan Hansen down the pub. We think he's hilarious. He should be on the radio. And he told me, he only told me that he'd done that once he'd sent the letter. So I sent the letter. I was like, what have you done that for? You silly bugger, you know. And I thought nothing more of it. Until one day I was cleaning the guitar counter at Musical Exchanges, you know, dusting it down. And I remember the tannoy thing at line 4-3 and down to line 4. The Ian Dancer is Tom Ross. So
they put on a competition.
No, I thought it was Keith.
Alright, yeah.
Putting the voice on having me at it. So I pick it up and say, hello. Hello. And it was Tom. Because Keith can't do impressions. So I knew it wasn't him, I knew it was Tom. And Tom told me that he'd had this letter, it interested him. And would I record something for him? So there wasn't an audition as such. I was basically told what he wanted. He wanted a 2-minute maximum sketch involving sort of local topical issues, but using whatever football voices I wanted to go out on the Saturday afternoon show prior to their 3 o'clock kickoff, whatever Capital Gold Extra AM, I think it might have been at that time, was playing out, whether it was Bluesville or Army, whatever. So I said, yeah, he said, I can't pay you for it. I said, it's fine, you know, it's something to do, it's just a string to the bow. So I went into the old BR&B studios on Aston Road North the night before it was due to come on air with a script that I'd written at home. Keith came with me as sort of moral support. I met Tom's producer, Guy Jogo, and we just recorded it. And it got played out the next day. So whether Tom heard it in the morning and said, yeah, that's fine, or whether he just said, just play it out, I'm sure it'll be
fine. So there's no margin for error, you just did it.
Yeah, I just knew I had to keep it clean and keep it local and keep it topical and keep it to under 2 minutes. So I did that. And 2 weeks later, his producer ran back, can we have another one? And that carried on through to the summer, by which time I had switched jobs to go to Cradley Heath. And of course, you know, June, July, I don't get any phone calls, and it kind of drifts out of my mind. August comes, my phone goes at my new job, and it's a new producer Tom's got who's saying, we'd like to use you again for sketches. We can pay you this time. And I think that sort of August 97, where it was a little ting, a little bell went off in my head saying, there might be more to this than I'm allowing myself to think about at the moment. And sure enough, we fast forward to February of 98. And again, I'm at my desk at Croydon Heath, and the phone rings, and it's Tom. He says, Dan, can you come in? Yeah, about half an hour. I've got stuff on. I need to see you. Okay. I made up a cock and bull story to my bosses at Laney that I needed to go into the jewellery quarter to pick up guitar parts. Took the works van, drove into Aston Road North, parked up, and Tom met me at reception, took me up to the programming floor, where I've been a couple of times, and walked up to the this door that said program controller, knocked on the door. I was ushered in and met the program controller at BR&B. I've not met him before that time. His name's Paul Jackson. Son of Richard Park, the famed Academy sort of austere sort of judge. And he basically offered me a job. Within 5 minutes of me sitting down in a chair like this in his office, he offered me the flying eye job. Why? Because because Tammy Gooding, who was doing it at the time, was going to go to work with Les Ross in the studio on the B&B Breakfast Show, like as a header. So there was a vacancy in the following night, and Paul, having heard my sketches, thought I would be the guy. So he's offered me the job there and then. I'm sitting there thinking, shit.
You've got to work one outside for your current job.
I've got to, yeah, well, the funny thing, we said I'd like to start next week, going up in the plane with Tammy for her final week and learn the ropes. And then the week after, ostensibly you're on your own. The funny thing was, that next week, I booked off work. Not to go anywhere, go on holiday, do anything, I just needed to get away from it. So it fell in my lap that I was able to then go up in the plane with Tammy that next week, watch her do what she did from a technical point of view and from a verbal point of view, learn what she was doing and how she did it. I got to do a couple of bulletins on the Friday for Tammy Butler's X-Ray MREC for show. Then that was it, the next week I was in. So the Friday afternoon after my training week, I drove to Laney, gave them the pill, said, sorry, I'm off.
You could believe it. The title is from this to I'm going to do this.
Lyndon Laney, who was the head honcho at Laney Amps, he was not happy, but understood, I think, about the opportunity that suddenly presented itself to me. That didn't mean he was going to be thrilled for me. But I think he understood that, from my perspective, it was a no-brainer. So that next week, my broadcasting career started in earnest.
Wow. It's funny, isn't it, how these things and karma and the universe fall into one.
Yeah.
So you've spent your whole life trying to do one thing, and then an opportunity that you weren't even looking for taken a completely different direction.
I'd done radio at Sixth Form College and enjoyed it. And we actually had Terry Christian and Radio 4 schools and colleges come to host a show from Solihull Sixth Form College. And I met him and, you know, but the producer that day said, if you want to get to radio, you need a degree. And because I was dead set on being a rock star, I had no intention of going to university, no intention of further education. My education, as I saw it, was, you know, the university of life. You know, get down on the road and get stuck in a transit van with four or five other degenerates and playing to various toilets up and down the country. You know, that was the vision I had in my mind. So, and then suddenly, this opportunity presents itself. I remember ringing my mum and dad after I got back to. So I'd been offered this job and I said yes. So I knew that the next week I was going on. Go back and get to my private little office space, ring my mum and dad, and say, shit, you can't believe what I've done here. And dad said, go for it. I know you're unhappy where you are. And that was all I needed to hear. Just that little bit of validation from the old man.
Have to say, oh, that's crazy. And
yeah.
And I take it you were following heights. There was no issue with that.
Heights I could deal with to an extent. I mean, you're going up in a twin-engine Seneca. Everyone thought it was a helicopter. I think it might have been in the very early days when Charlie Neal did the flying eye. But by the time I was doing it, by the time Tammy was doing it before me, it was a Seneca twin-engine.
Right. Yeah, it's always just because that's the view of eating media. You're always there's someone with the headphones like leaning out of the helicopter.
It's like that Arnie Pie in the Sky. It's The Simpsons, isn't it? You know, so... On windy days, it was not fun because you would get buffeted around and you would take clients up quite often, advertisers with the station, prize winners sometimes, and sometimes you'd be circling a road traffic accident somewhere on a motorway or major road, and they get decidedly queasy in the back. So the sick bags that were provided came in handy on more than the odd occasion. But on the days when it was sunny and there wasn't a cloud in the sky and barely a breath of wind, it was felt like the best job in the world at the time to do that. But of course from that, things developed.
Yeah. So from the eye in the sky, within 3 years, you were doing Drive Time. So obviously, that was a pretty accelerated rise. How did it move so quickly? How did you go from one to another so quickly?
I mean, a lot of belief in me from Paul Jackson, the BR&B program controller, and he was a hard taskmaster, and he wanted the best for me. Because pretty soon after starting doing the Flying Eye, he started offering me cover shifts on Extra AM, doing the Elvis Hour or the Beatles Hour that they used to have. And that was very simple. That was, this is radio, just to learn the basics of coming in and coming out of records, reading out requests, reading out, you know, those, you know, people having Beatles or Elvis get-togethers, things like that. So you understood the basic structure of how a radio show should sound. And then from that, he tried me out on Sunday evenings on BR&B in mid-98. But again, he was not enough of my personality was coming out. So he stuck me on overnight, Saturday night to Sunday morning. He said, I want you to carte blanche, do what you want. You know what you're doing in the Flying Eye with Les? Do that over the course of 6 hours, midnight till 6 a.m. Bring people in if you want, I'll pay them, it's fine. Just, I want to hear more of you. And
I bet that was great.
That was when the Barmy Brummies came into being as a title. And radio presenters will tell you about this thing called, I don't know whether they do it anymore these days, in music radio anyway, it's called a snoop session, where you would take a blank cassette into the radio studio with you, put it in the machine, and you'd set it to record and pause. Every time you open the microphone fader, do a link, it would go to record and play on the cassette recorder and record your link. When you turn the fader, when you pull the fader down, switch the mic off, and the next record started, it would spool around for another 2 seconds and then go back to record and pause. So effectively, that cassette would just have all your links on there and nothing else.
Oh, okay.
So you record that when requested, and at the end of your show, you would then take that cassette, put it in this box, and put it under the door of the program controller for them to listen to the next day.
Okay. So I think it's any tidbits that they can.
Yeah, and snoop sessions were brutal. Right. You know, people coming out of there in tears sometimes, you know, because of the way that their whole presenting style was basically cut to ribbons.
Yes, that's what Dan Kelly had said to us before, wasn't it? It is quite ruthless and quite cutthroat because you're vulnerable in that you're saying, this is what I'm doing. I think this is good, this is funny, and someone's telling you, it's not all you need to challenge this.
You know, and you, a similar sort of thing happened when I started getting into the football, working for Tom, that there were certain things that you should and there were do's and do nots, and you learn very quickly to avoid the do nots. And I snooped the first overnight Barmy Brummies because they'd asked me to. We want to hear what the because they weren't going to be listening live.
Yeah,
at the hour, half past 12 on Saturday night, Sunday morning. So I snooped it, put it under his desk, his door rather, as I left, bleary eyed first thing Sunday morning. Monday morning, I'd come back from the Flying Eye, doing my shift, and my answer machine was beeping. Pressed it, and it was Paul Jackson saying, Dance, it's Paul, sitting here with Mark. Mark was the head of music, listening to the show. Brilliant, just what I've been wanting to hear. Well, that's exactly what we want from you. More of the same, please. Thanks, bye. That was it. So, again, another little light bulb moment. Okay, let's develop what we did overnight, whether it was just, you know, doing silly voices or gags and things like that. And so the Barmy Brummies quickly, it had a short stint on overnights, but he was so happy with what we were doing. It went in three really weird stages in between, I would say, let me get this right. Before you got to between 99 and 2000, we moved from Saturday to Sunday overnights to Saturday early breakfast, so 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. So condensed it down to 2 hours. And then he was so happy with that, the Barmy Brummies then got shifted to Saturday breakfast, 8 till 12. And then from that, he was so happy with that, he took us off weekends and put us on weekdays, early afternoons, 2 till 4. And then by May of 2000, April, May of 2000, that was when we got given drive time, 4 till 7.
Which is absolute prime time.
Absolute prime time. So it was just stages of, okay, that you could feel that because you were moving up in terms of potential audience shares, you were moving up in terms of, you know, what was expected of you.
Did you start feeling the pressure then of the sketches?
Yes, probably more so once we went weekdays, because any show, and you know, some of my radio heroes, people like Mark and Lard on Radio 1, I couldn't doubt that show and just put material, which is why we needed the benchmark items like Mark and Lard had with, you know, Lard's Classic Cuts and Fat Harry White and, you know, things like that, and Down Counts and Missing Words. So we needed benchmarks that were run as the Barmy Brummies, and that's where Des's Dedications came from, Black Country Bob, the politically incorrect MP for Dudley. We had the Beckhams as a recurring sketch that was kind of Terry and June piss tape. We had the Mr. Men stories, like fake Mr. Men stories read by Arthur Lowe that didn't actually make the cut from the ones that we saw on telly or read in books. And they were important because, you know, they weren't topical, they weren't necessarily having to be topical,
yeah,
but there was plenty of topical stuff you had to do. So yeah, there was immense pressure.
I assume as well that it's more difficult doing a radio sketch show than a TV sketch show, because you've got obviously audio visual.
No, I love theatre of the mind. Theatre of the mind. So Black Country Bob is this loudmouth MP for Dudley who shouts his mouth off at Tony Blair across the dispatch box of Prime Minister's Question Time. So they can see it in their mind's eye, the listener. They probably picture what they think Black Country Bob looks like.
Yeah.
I wasn't the voice of Black Country Bob. That was Sean Person, one of my writing partners who came in to work with me. Very funny guy, still does stand-up. Really funny guy. So he was the voice of Black Country Bob. I was the voice of Blair, and we're firing off little sound effects. So we're recording the sketch as live, and I'm firing off boos and yeahs and things like that. And it was really, I love doing that. That's my favourite sketch that we used to do, because it was funny, B, it was challenging, and C, it clearly resonated with the Birmingham public, because I was told that item, Black Country Bob, and Des's Dedications, where Des Lynam reads out sort of innuendo-strewn dedication to a workplace. I was told that the production line at the Rover stopped. To stop the machinery so they could hear what crap Black Country Bob was coming out with this week.
Brilliant.
So I affected productivity.
You were the reason it's no longer there.
Yeah. I shouldn't be too proud of that, really. But that was the... You understood the power of the particularly independent local radio had at that time, whether it was BRNB in Birmingham, whether it was Capital in London, or, you know, Red Dragon in South Wales, or Trent in Nottingham. That's, you know, they all had that power.
Yeah.
To, you know, really connect with an audience.
At that time,
mm.
I was reading on your bio with Des. I remember Des, but you were singing at Alexander Stadium from the 30,000 people, a parody of Craig David's Seven Days.
That was the most voice. Bizarre thing ever. So very early on in the Des's Dedications thing, Andy Robinson, another of my fellow, another brilliant stand-up comic, came up with this idea that Des Lynam was chasing after an unnamed female within, you know, his sphere, and he was going to... we came up with the idea because we had a backing track of Seven Days lying around. This was in the very early days of you know, solo artists and bands having CD backing tracks that they would come into the studio and sing live over. So there was this backing track of Seven Days lying around. Andy comes back with this idea that Des sleeps with this girl and ends up, you know, what was it? Monday, took her a drink on Tuesday, and we were making love by Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Nasty rash on Monday. Went to the clinic on the Tuesday, antibiotics on the Wednesday, and Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, cleared up on Sunday. And again, boy, oh boy, did that hit home with the BRNB listeners. To the extent that I was asked by the programme controller at the next party in the park we did, at Alexander Stadium to put on a Des Lynam wig and go out there in front of 30,000 people and do what I and sing that song in front of, and I got a wild round of applause. It was just, I mean, you know, I'd spent years before. I thought, yeah, you know, all the years playing on the toilets up and down the UK, thrashing around on my drums and, you know, never thinking of it. Here I am putting on a blonde wig and a moustache. And suddenly, it's acceptance, you know, for doing something as daft as that. So, yeah, again, you understood the power of what a good sketch or a good character or good local radio can do. It just,
because at that time,
makes people laugh.
Yourself, Les Ross, Jezza.
Yes.
I mean, this was the time. This was around the time with Two Strangers wedding, wasn't it?
And
it was national news, wasn't it? Yeah. Everything was national news at the time, right?
I think BR&B had their highest ever reach, you know, percentage of audience share around that time. Because, yes, you had Les Ross in the morning, Graham Mack doing his brilliant comedy stuff, sort of 9 till 12. Then you had Ricardo, 96.4 minutes of music without any ads. Then it was me. Then it was Scott Hughes with his, pop star guests and film reviews. Then Jeremy Kyle Jezza, late live, which became Jezza's Confessions at 10 p.m. I mean, it was a real heavyweight lineup of personality radio.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really what it put. The personalities everywhere. And it was an absolute privilege to be a part of. And because of the unorthodox route I had taken, certainly compared to anybody else, there were times when, do I deserve this? I feel a little bit fraudulent that I just sort of almost been fast-tracked into this position of being the drive time presenter, you know, over and above certain others who might have argued they deserve that role.
I was going to say, did you find as you became more successful and it became more popular, did you find then these other pressures within the station and around the roles that you're having to do?
The only pressure was the pressure you put upon yourself, generally speaking, to make sure that the content of what you did was funny and hit home. And the only thing I added up, because Paul Jackson left and another program controller came in and he wanted me to do more funny phone calls. I never liked doing funny phone calls. So we butted heads about that a lot. I was much happier doing the sketches and the parody songs that we used to do. That's me being creative in the way I enjoy, particularly the parody songs, which I still do to this day on Planet Rock. But yeah, there were certain aspects I didn't want to do, which I felt I was being railroaded into doing, and I fought against that. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, you policed yourself. But I've got every sketch and song we ever did on mini discs stored somewhere in the back cave.
You got the Beatles memorabilia and
they shall never be heard. They shall never be heard, because there's probably so much stuff on there that if I was to play out in 2024.
Is it like the time capsule
there? I think it is. I think there's just a.
Oh, put that back in.
Yeah. I can say where it is. There might be a certain element, not constant, but just questionable. Blimey, went a bit far there.
It was a different time, wasn't it? This is a whole contradiction, isn't it, with what we're looking at now. We live in a very broken aware society, don't we? And the rules don't apply, or can't apply to things that happened 20 years ago in comedy especially, isn't it? It's been absolutely
the parody songs I do now, we're very careful about how we approach the lyrical content.
If you're not Planet Rock, you've got to...
Yeah, and the bosses have to approve it before it goes on air. So I record it, I send it to them, and only once or twice have they said,
I'm not sure about what you think. Yeah.
And I've changed it or abandoned it.
Well, the difference is now with Planet Rock as opposed to what BR&B was like back in the day.
Well, obviously it's a national music radio set, and it's playing the music I love. You know, BR&B did play stuff that I liked, but it played a lot of stuff that was from genres that I didn't really follow.
Yeah.
But that wasn't a problem. It's funny when I hear songs played at football stadium now, if I hear Lady by Mojo or Music Sounds Better With You by Stardust, does it?
Yeah, that
gives me a nice warm fuzzy feeling about going back to those days at BR&B and playing those songs and knowing how popular they were. Feel So Good, Sonic, oh my God, I hear that song again. It won't be too soon. Looking for Love, Karen Ramirez. I knew it was about 10 to 6 in the morning when I was playing that because it just seemed to be scheduled for that sort of time.
Yeah.
So there are songs that...
Yeah, because the chords and the Robbie Williams song from the time as well, they were playing constantly for...
Let Me Entertain You and She's
for the
Warm.
For the wedding, for the
that, but all radio was doing that at the time. There were big songs. Back for Good was probably the first example I can think of, or Torn by Natalie Imbruglia, where all radio stations hammered those songs. It was played on the hour every 3 hours, maybe even every 2, I don't know, but certainly it was hammered because it was a popular song. For Planet Rock these days, the music that I play is 98% of which is on my, my playlist or whatever it may be. And I'm speaking to an audience that I relate to because I meet them at gigs and I meet them at festivals that I work out for Planet Rock. So it's a very comfortable working environment for me. They do try and make sure, unless you're doing an hour from a specific year like the Planet Rock years at 9 o'clock every morning that Paul does, you'll maybe start with a song from the 70s, you won't play a 70s song second, you'll go to a different decade. Go to the 90s there's at least two or three current songs and now from the current A and B playlist that they have, so there is a science to it.
Isn't there a rule as well that you don't play a female artist and a band or a...
No, I don't think that I know I've played Heart and Steve and Nicks back to back, I'm sure I have in things like that. That doesn't happen. Certainly a Planet Rock myth, whether that applies to Capital or other radio stations, I don't know. But no, Planet Rock is, there's a structure to it, but it at least allows me to be creative with the parody songs that I've put together because it gives my show a unique selling point and the listeners seem to enjoy it. And sometimes I come up with the parody songs that I'm really, I've done all right there. I did one for Marillion. Fish was selling his gaff in the West Highlands or something. So I did a version of Lavender, all about the lavatories, because he's taking it on the tour of the house. I didn't realise I could sing vaguely like Fish. Vaguely. Enough to make it sound funny.
Yeah.
So,
Have you ever dropped one that you thought was absolutely bang on the money and it fell flat? Or the other way, where you're like, and then it's just compensated.
Sometimes you're not, back in the day on BR&B, there was a story about a blaze at a Centre Parks. Nobody was injured. and I had to put it all together with the drum machine and guitar and bass, bouncing track. We had to do a version of Blur's Park Life, and it was Centre Park Fire. I get up on all one, except yesterday morning when I was woken by a raging inferno, Centre Park Fire. So this is about the year 2000. All the people, so many people, they all go, I had to stress before I played out, nobody was hurt. It was just a fire that had to be contained at a Centre Park somewhere. And I thought, this is going to get me in so much trouble. And it didn't. It actually went down really well with the listeners.
That's brilliant.
How many listeners have you got now, Planet Rock?
Oh, over a million. Over a million listeners per week to Planet Rock. It's one of the biggest digital-only stations.
Right.
It doesn't have an FM frequency. It did have one around here, 105.2,
yeah,
for a little while, going back 10 years or so, maybe. But no, as a digital station, it's got... it's 25 years old next month, and it's still going very, very strong.
Excellent,
great. It's amazing to be a part of it.
Do you remote it?
Yes, you can. They do have studios down in London, but you can work from home and record remotely. Yeah, yeah.
Have you got a home studio as well? Is that where you record your?
Yes, I've got a home. We can put Irish songs together there, and guitars and electronic drum kit and things like that. No, okay. So I'm self-sufficient in that regard. Yeah.
Okay. So, radio, unbelievable success. You then transitioned to TV.
Yeah.
I
was released from BR&B in the summer of 2002. I wasn't expecting it. They had a complete that program controller who came in, who I mentioned, who disagreed with about funny phone calls. He was making a lot of changes. Graham Mack had gone. I went not long after Les went. It was a complete change from personality radio to more music they wrote. They basically just wanted to get more songs away.
Yeah.
Burn out. I was one of the victims of that. So I was very much at a loose end. Although I was, by that time, established as a football commentator working for Tom Ross for Capital Gold, which the name changed from X-Ray M. So I kept my hand in there. But I was looking for something else to do. And that's where a guy called Steve Bennett came in, who was a massive fan of the Barnaby Brummies, who was launching a shopping channel in Redditch.
So how did that come about? He just rocked and Hodkins, his Frank and
one of his fellow board members, Debbie Cavill, used to be the lady that relayed me information when I was in the Flying Eye.
Right.
So said, you need to go here to check. So we had a friendship.
She became a presenter of the
show. Yeah. Yeah, she became part of the presenting team at this shopping semi channel, which went through a number of different names before it settled on a format called Snatch It, which was like a reverse auction channel, which was very, very successful. And the whole ethos of this TV station that we joined was irreverence and, you know, having a lot of fun with it all rather than being, you know, stiff-backed and QVC and, you know.
Disruptive.
Yeah, disruptive, slightly anarchic, but still, you know, call to action. Well, this is what's on, this is what the price point is, blah, blah, blah. And it took off. It really took off, and there were seven or eight of us who were on shift work. So, it was a mad, mad time. And then from that, a guy came in one day who was a gemstone dealer from Thailand. American guy, Canadian, forgive me, I can't remember. But he came in to meet Steve. So this is early 2004. And from that one meeting that he had, suddenly the whole ethos of the station changed. It was now going to become a jewellery channel, Gem Stevie, which is still going now. It's 20 years old this month.
Yeah, because I'd read in your information, you went out there, didn't you?
Went out to Thailand and we did a training course. All the presenters, and there were quite a few by this time, a good, you know, 14, 15 presenters who worked on different shifts, learning about gemstones and learning about, you know, mining and, you know, cutting of gemstones and gold, silver.
Product knowledge.
Product knowledge, absolutely. So you would then come back from that training course and be ready to be knowledgeable. Then the channel became a little bit more austere, still a little room for fun, but the wild days of, you know, karaoke machines and...
Yeah, and as the joke got more expensive, you got...
Electric scooters it was basically gems. But again, it proved wildly successful, proven by the fact that it's still going now. I probably worked about 5 years at those studios in between the various different formats that were tried. Loved it. Another string to the bow, I suppose you could say.
How's that as a transition going in front of the camera from behind a marker in a studio?
Oh, that didn't bother me.
No.
That didn't bother me, really. I do have a face for radio, but I wasn't fussed about being on camera. I didn't feel particularly self-conscious. And when you're working in an environment like that where it's just anarchy, all your inhibitions will drop away immediately, or they'll get even worse and you're not going to last. So,
well, we spoke up, and Drew and Lucy and I kind of done some work in the past.
Well, a lot of these people, Drew and Lucy and Teo.
Just to speak, some they're born into science.
Yeah, and they worked in like an acting drama company called Crag Rats and things like that. They used to go around schools and, you know, perform.
Oh, yeah.
So they had this incredible self-confidence to perform.
But that's infectious, then.
Yeah, and that was taken into the selling job. And of course, I had been a salesman not 5 or 6 years before selling guitars, so I knew how to sell to people. And one of the basic premises of sales is people buy things from people they like and they can empathize with and, you know, like speaking to or hearing from. So everybody that was involved in Satchit or then Gems TV was, I thought, you know, a likeable, friendly, approachable person, and the sales figures proved that, you know, we were likeable and, you know, we were offering something that the public wanted to, you know, to delve into and buy. But no, I had no problems going in front of the camera, particularly.
Do you remember the information regarding the Gems and the Jewels? Is that still?
Yeah. Well, some of it, yeah. I could, if you ask me what, I mean, September's birth, Sapphire, you know, I can still remember certain things. But it's like French. It's like we do French at O-level, and then you go to France, 10 years later, it's all gone.
Bits.
Yeah, bits. Just little bits. But I suppose if you stood in front of a camera there now at Gems TV and said, sell that tourmaline bracelet, I'd probably muddle my way through it. Get some of the way there. Not completely, but it's a different skill set.
Yeah.
To what I'd done before. It was a valuable skill set to learn, definitely.
Have you ever been offered another TV since?
Nope. No, I've always been...
I suppose radio. You know, there's nothing. So Birmingham Live, just digressing slightly. Birmingham Live and stuff isn't here anymore and stuff like that. But I think you probably.
I was there when that was launched. I remember when that started.
Topless Stars.
Live TV. Yeah. Well, I remember being approached by them. I think I went in there and I did a couple of bits with them, but no more than a couple of bits. There was never any sort of.
Peaky Blinders.
Well, I go in there as a consultant on the Birmingham accent, I think.
It does need it in parts.
One or two.
Yeah.
One or two. But then they'll say that the Birmingham accent sounded like that in the 1920s. So who am I? Wasn't around at that time. So I'd ask my granddad, but he's not here to ask. So, you know, there we go.
Sitting down here at St Andrews, Knighthead Park at St Andrews, it would be remiss not to discuss the club currently. Within your bio as well, you mentioned commentating and interviewing Sir Trevor Francis.
Yes.
As one of your first actual, was it post-match, pre-match?
Pre-match.
Were you getting the nod on the team?
I was getting the nod on the team. So I've been working for Tom for a little while, at BRMB Capital all that time. And he sent me to Bristol Rovers for a League Cup tie, Bristol Rovers against Blues. And he said,
Trevor will give you the team, go to the tunnel, and ask for me, and he'll come and see. Okay, all right, so I'll ask you. This is my first hero, you know. I've got a blue shirt on underneath this, which has got the number 8 on the back, the old penguin strip.
Beautiful, beautiful strip.
And that was Trev's number. So I do as I'm told. I get set up in the stand. I go down to the tunnel of Bristol Rovers. So could you let Trevor Francis know that Cap of Gold is here? And he comes out and I interview him. I get the steer on the team. Finished the interview with my cassette recorder. Thank you, Travis, for your chat at the end. And I switched the cassette bar, and he just went, 8 out of 10, very good. And turned around and walked back down the tunnel. He was marking me out of 10 for my interviewing style, because I think he'd probably been tipped off by someone. There's a cub reporter coming down.
There's a rookie.
Rookie. Being like, don't throw him under the bus, don't cuss upon him. So that was my first thing. I was to ring my dad. Just spoke to Trevor Bloody Francis, because, you know, my dad was a blue nose, my granddad, my great uncle Jack used to work here, Jack the Hat, Jack Danza. He was did all sorts of menial duties around the stadium until he was in his 70s, you know, from sweeping the terraces to helping with the turnstiles and everything. So the Danzas had a real connection to Birmingham City. So to come back here in any role, whether it was to do the stadium announcing that I did here at the end of the 90s, or to come back here as a commentator, as I still do now for Talk Sport, it's not lost on me how fortunate I am to get to do that. Because, I love this place. how could I not? I first came here when I was six, I think. We got beat 2-0 by Stoke on a cold December afternoon. Jimmy Greenoff scored, having not long been with us, gone to Stoke. So my first game here, I was taught, this is what Birmingham City will do to you. Ex-players will come back and haunt you, so it was the perfect indoctrination into life as a...
Joys and sorrows.
Yeah, exactly. Well, mostly sorrows, right? But there's been a few joys.
It seems like so with everything going on down here now. Because, again, reading on your bio, your thoughts on Trev, how long it took and how close we were so many times when he was manager.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd like to think that obviously before he passed, he took credit in the team that went up. And I know that there was a saying around the club that they tried to make, after the Chinese ownership, they tried to kind of build bridges and get him involved, hadn't they? But they hadn't been able to do that before he passed. So you'd like to think that before he went, he knew what the club, the people around the club, what he meant to them.
I hope that he knew the day we got promoted at Cardiff, what part he played. I hope he knew that day, and I hope that somebody, it could have been Steve Bruce, might have called it. He came back here 3 years after that. Martin Granger's testimonial. I played that. I've got 20 minutes that night. Trevor passed me the ball. But I'm sure I said to him that night, in all seriousness, I hope you understand what me and all right-minded Blue Noses think, that a big part of us getting into the Premier League was down to the groundwork that you did from, 96 to 2001, and it shouldn't be forgotten. But Trevor was not one for taking compliments, particularly. He was a very shy man.
Yeah.
Quite introverted in a lot of ways. So you didn't go overboard with the praise.
Yeah.
But it's obvious how much this club meant to him. And it shouldn't do, in theory, because he's a Devonian. He's a Plymouth boy.
Yeah.
This club just gets under your skin.
Story I heard, it's Nick Eden on the podcast, and he said at times at the training ground, he was practicing free kicks afterwards, because Nick Eden had a piece of free kick on him, didn't it? They had the dummies there, and he's trying to get it up and over, and he's standing there after, and he said, Trevor just turned up, and he went, just do like this, and he's just whipped one straight in the top bins. And he's gone, just do like that. And he's gone, gaff, if I could do like that, I wouldn't be at fucking Blues.
I'll tell you a funny story about Trev. He was the one that introduced the tambura as the walk-on music. He gave that CD to me to play because his son James had bought it and liked it and suggested the players should run out of that. So Trev gave me the CD single to play out, and I ended up making a loop of it. So that clapping thing at the start kept going for longer. So it allowed players to come out from the tunnel in the corner and, make it all work. In the original version, the vocal cuts in too soon.
Yeah.
Because so I did wait for my wedding. We walked out and
did
it was excellent wedding breakfast to you. And I had to edit the bill a little bit longer.
The artist was local, wasn't she? That she was someone's brother or sister.
Something like that.
In Marston Green.
Yeah. So that was his first idea, which he still used
to. Iconic,
His next idea was based on something that Bolton Wanderers used to do. You might remember when they scored at the Reebok, as it was known then, they used to play James Brown, "I Feel Good," after every goal. Wow, that'd be again. Punters used to do all that.
Yeah.
And Trevor came to me and said, "I want something similar but different. Can you come to West Hills next week and chat to the first team squad members about what song they would like played for them when they score, like individual goal music?" I thought, well, that's interesting. Okay, so the next week I went to West Hills as the players were having lunch, walked in. First player I walked up to was Martin Granger. So I introduced myself as a stadium announcer, where Trevor's got this idea, individual goal music. If you had your own individual goal music, what song would you pick? And without a hesitation, he just looked up at me deadpan and went, "Please release me." In the world, I'm putting. And I thought at that moment, this isn't going to work.
they're not going to take this seriously.
Smack my bitch up.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So you've got, they're all laughing around the table, you know. They're all like it
at the inside as to where you were committed.
So that's Martin just thinking straight away, please release me, let me go. So I went to trust that this isn't going to work, that this is not going to buy it. So that fell by the wayside, unfortunately.
But then goes and writes for music, as general,
no, they're sponsored, isn't it? And any goal that's scored here, goal scored by number, 11, whoever, sponsored by the Easy Group. The Who thing, that was something that I inadvertently created. I didn't mean to create it, but I did.
Oh, was that you? Was that you?
Well, the Who thing was about, for those that don't know, so when I was doing the stadium announcing, when substitutions occurred, I wanted the player coming off for Birmingham and the player coming on to know that they were being appreciated either for what they'd done or what hopefully they were going to do. So I would leave a gap. So I would say, substitution for Birmingham City, replacing number 9, Dele Adebola, pause, and that would mean round of applause from around the stadium for what he'd done. Coming on number 11, Peter Unlove. And he'd get a round of applause. Now, just because of muscle memory, I started doing the same for the opposition teams as well. And the Blues fans, being the devilish, rogues that they are, only in little pockets at first, started going, who? Well, I would say, coming off for Barnsley, number 7, David Flitcroft, who? Number 11, person-to-person phase, yeah. Who? And then it grew and grew and grew.
It's the way you put the the doubt.
I did that to a degree. The best ever was when Newcastle came in with the League Cup. Bobby Robson's Newcastle United. They had a man sent. Shea Given got sent off, I think. Goalkeeper. Yeah. Percy scored, and we were 2-0 up. Shearer was playing. It was about an hour gone, and in those days the substitute wasn't on the LED boards; it was on the cards. I remember, and Rob Shannon, Blues fan legend, sat beside me in the commentary box. He suddenly digs me, hey, they're getting number 9 ready. Shearer's coming off. And we said, oh my God, what a moment is this going to be? So I press the microphone, the approach, so play stops. It's clear that this, is coming up. Substitution for Newcastle United, and I swear to you, so I'm down there in the commentary box in between the built banks of dugout seats. All around the ground, it was shh. There was a complete silence to set up for this moment. And I just waited to look. Replacing number 9, Alan Shearer, 26,000 blue notices, all did that. I can't remember who came on for him, but he got there. But they lived for that little moment, the Blues fans.
Oh, had. Yeah.
So that's something I inadvertently created, and the Blues fans ran with like crazy.
So now I don't know who the announcer is now, but he really piles it on, doesn't he?
He went away for a while. Yeah.
Well, Keith Lorenz, who took when I started getting more and more work with Captain Gold as a football reporter, I had to leave this job behind. So Keith Lorenz, my best mate, took over, and he once got in trouble when Bolton were here, because he said, replacing number 10, Oliver Johnson, who? Number 12, Bo Hansen, who? I said, Bo Hansen. So he got in trouble for that. And even when I was doing it, we were told that there were clubs that took issue with the way I was saying it. But
I remember there seemed to be a tipping point. It got so far, and then it got really rude, and it becomes such a comical thing. But then it flattened out a little bit, so you actually get carpeted. And
I never got told not to do it.
No,
I just knew that there'd been complaints that had come in from other clubs. But as far as the club are concerned, let them complain.
Yeah, because you spoke to Marcus Painter a couple of weeks ago, didn't you? And he played when he marked Ronaldo at the game, and he got subbed there. So I've seen that on Twitter and that as well, where only Blues fans could say Cristiano Ronaldo, who?
Brilliant. I mean, I love that. That's just so cockeyed.
Blues fans are so fast sometimes, aren't they?
Well, football fans in general, we've got some of the quickest witted supporters, I think. And that might be down to the years of torment, you know, and the promotes that gallows humour and just means that some Blues fans are so quick off the mark. It's just have to tip the hat sometimes and go, fair play, lads.
This is the Wrexham game, and it was you can shut your Deadpool up, your Deadpool.
Well, they were doing that. Apparently, Keith told me there were people walking back under the Borsley Bridge, and a bus went past with the Deadpool Wolverine advert on the side, and they were all they were crowded around this bus. You can see you fucking Deadpool, you're off. This poor bus driver. Probably you do it on the 50 or whatever whatever route he's doing. He's suddenly surrounded. No idea why. Why are you singing that at me?
That's no idea.
Can't explain to his wife like that happened.
Yeah. He started singing to me about Deadpool. I don't. He didn't know what necessarily know what that book was on the side of his bus. But there we go. Yeah.
What's your favourite moment then, Bruce? It's not on the questions.
Favourite moment?
Yeah.
Oh, it's got to be 2011.
Yeah.
The League Cup, it's got to be up there. I mean, there's been nights here that have been pretty special. The semi-final against Ipswich.
That for me personally, that's my standout.
West Ham as well.
West Ham in the semi-final, the comeback. I can also think back further to when this stand had got long been built, when Brentford came here, the promotion season from what is now League One, 94-95, we had to beat Brentford. We just won the auto win screens, and there was a bumper crowded here that night. And Kevin Francis and Liam Daish scored, and you could feel the stadium shake. The Enkelman game here against the Villa.
Yeah, yeah.
I was in the Tilton that night, and I've never felt. No wonder it had been structural problems, because that stand literally shook that night when Morrison opened the scoring.
Yeah.
So, yeah, for all that we do the gallows humour stuff, you know, there's been more than enough glorious moments down here that you know you can just smile about. How lucky was I to be there for that?
Still for the highlights in that Martins, the split second when it drops, you just can hear a pin drop.
Yes, anything could happen. Floodlight failure.
It still gives me a bit of
could have been floodlight failure, you know, thermonuclear war could have started. Would have been typical Blues for something to stopped us winning it, or you just ballooned it over the bar, I suppose. But no, he goes and sticks it in the back of the net. Still the best joke in history, isn't it? A Frenchman walks into a pole and Birmingham City win the League Cup. Thank you, Wojciech Szczesny and Laurent Koscielny.
It's a little slap he got around the back of the air for his troubles.
Was that Barry Ferguson? Yeah. Just what you needed.
By the way, what's your favourite impression? And can we have one?
Oh, God.
I was listening to on the air, so before you came in.
Yes.
Listening to Des. Heather Mills song.
Heather Mills.
Yeah, it's like cultural moments in time, isn't it? When you look back on, because you pick moments, you look back, I remember that was a thing in the news.
It's like making baby photos for me, some of those sketches and songs and things. I'm like, oh God, where was my mind at when that?
Did you ever go too far with the Des Lynam's in kind of?
No, we never a complaint upheld about Des. We once did go too far with Black Country Bob. I shan't say why, but we did go too far and acknowledge it and apologise for it. But that was in our Heart FM days, so in all the time that we were on BRMB, never one complaint upheld. But Des's dedications was no different really to Julian and Sandy that Kenneth Williams had been doing on Radio 4 years before. Or indeed Fat Harry White that Marvin Lyle were doing. It's just a similar furrow to that. Favourite impression? Well, I mean, if we're talking now, I suppose my Jim Way is probably up there. You're working with him at Talk Sport. Breaking news here, Natalie, this is huge. Not only is it huge, it's massive. Thomas Tuchel is becoming the England manager. You know, that's enormous news. You know, everything becomes, you know. I'm not sure I've done it to his face, no.
I think you definitely need to tie Simon Jordan into that then as well.
If I could do a Simon Jordan, then I'd be well away. But that's work in progress.
Yeah.
And I'm not prepared to display that work in progress right now.
No drafts. Yeah.
No.
But just, again, I know we've got to wrap up, but what What are your thoughts on Thomas Tuchel as an appointment?
We're after success, aren't we?
Yeah, I'm fairly ambivalent to it. I don't understand the confected outrage. Mm. It's like saying that Fabio Capello never happened, the way I've heard some of it framed.
Well, one of our pals, it's, oh, I can't believe you've got a German manager, and one of our other pals, but you wanted Klopp? Yeah, no, that's different.
You see, you become anglicised in people's minds after a time that sort of permits that.
Yeah. Because we were linked with Klinsmann back in the day as well, weren't we? During that time.
And that would have been a similar thing to Klopp. I think the fact that he spent time here and was a very personable character.
Yeah.
I think Tuchel has this, there's this perception that he's quite abrasive and that might work against him, but I think the accusation is that he doesn't manage up very well, but doesn't really have to worry about that as an England manager. What he's got to worry about is picking the right 23 players for a squad and formulating a team and tactics around that. So,
Charlie evidently didn't want it.
No, but then he didn't. I think the glare and the spotlight, he really isn't that guy. I mean, you know, there was talk of him even coming here at one point. I don't think he ever really entertained being anything more than a caretaker. I think he enjoys, genuinely enjoys being behind the scenes and the graft and everything that being an under-21s manager allows you to do without that being in that goldfish bar.
Yeah, yeah. I like the fact that he said in the interview, I made a charity, I tried it. Well, I won nothing in 66, so I tried it. I'll do it again in a heartbeat, same thing.
Yeah.
Try a different system. And that's... Yeah, it doesn't seem like the confidence of some of these jobs, being a journalist yourself, you find that there's sometimes these certain styles of journalists who just want to poke a bear and get that reaction at any cost rather than have an adult conversation.
They call them the professionally offended, don't they? And unfortunately, there's too much of that in our media nowadays. Confected outrage, professionally offended commentators, not just in sport, but in politics and you know, current affairs and things like that. There is a desperation to find offence. There is a desperation to be politically partisan to the point at which it's quite embarrassing at times. Unfortunately, I don't think we're ever going to lose that. Mm. It might get lessened slightly, but it's here. And it works, it seems. For some sections of the population who gorge on that sort of confected outrage.
It was comedy in COVID, wasn't it, where there were certain people that enjoyed the isolation, phoning police, there's someone outside, the neighbours snooping on neighbours, grassing neighbours up because they liked being inside, being away, they don't want to see other people out. It's created a really weird kind of psychological rewired of people's
really
brains.
What, 4 years on from COVID and the lockdowns, and I think it's going to take a long while for the after effects of that from society's point of view to sort of ease off and be less and less of a factor. You've still got people that are poorly with long COVID. You know, there's all sorts of strands that have come out of this pandemic. Social problems, mental health problems, you know, long-term health issues, what it's meant for what we think of our government and how we think we're being run. There's so many threads to it all.
One of the threads being that you read Steve Bruce's Crawl novel.
Well,
Steve Bruce's,
this was just because TalkSport were looking desperate for content when lockdown had hit. And I actually started doing a Barmy Old podcast thing, digging out those mini discs that I mentioned earlier with old Army Brummies and Heart FM sketches on there, and playing them out whilst eventually writing some new stuff. And Paul Hawksby of Hawksby and Jacobs, the TalkSport afternoon show, heard this one sketch I put out where I was doing a Steve Bruce impression. He said, "Look, we've got this idea. Steve Bruce genuinely wrote murder mystery novels in the late 90s. There's barely any copies anywhere. I've got a copy of the first book, courtesy of our colleague Martin Kellner. We wonder whether you could read it out in the style of Steve Bruce for some content, so we sort of kills 5 minutes every day." So this book, Striker, all about this manager, Steve Barnes, who's the manager at Leathersford Town, some nondescript town somewhere near the M62, you know, has to solve a murder mystery where one of his players is found with a knife in his back.
I remember this book coming out. I remember it being the son. What a competition here. Dan Kelly in the, in the Jasper. That was one of the questions. I was like, what? No one knows. Steve Bruce wrote these books.
He wrote three.
Yeah, he was in the Sun at the time. It was like national news.
So bizarre.
So I started reading it, and as time went on, I started putting little in-jokes in there in amongst what had genuinely been written. There's a whole two-page section where he goes, genuinely writes about how brilliant his Jaguar is. And it's clearly Steve Bruce was after a nice, you know, deal from his Jaguar dealership. Honestly, it was like reading Top Gear, a feature review of a Jaguar XJ or whatever it was he was driving. So, of course, you're reading that, you're having some fun with it, and you put some extra little bits in. So, you know, that was, there was talk, because as we got towards the end of the book, we were sort of coming out of the first lockdown, but we could not finish it, you know. There was talk that Steve could have read the last chapter for us, had Newcastle been on a better run, because he'd heard about it, he thought it was funny. And his agent had said, yeah, if Newcastle are doing all right and there's no, you know, conflict of interest, or yeah, exactly, he doesn't want to be perceived as being
taking the
mate, then he could read the last chapter, but that unfortunately never came to be. But it had his seal of approval, you know.
That's brilliant, that is. Absolutely brilliant. Just on that, we are going to let you go. Do you get a lot of feedback from the impressions you get from the people you do the impressions of? Has anyone ever said, look, I'm not being funny, can you knock that out yet?
The funniest line no one's ever said, please don't do an impression of me.
Yeah.
Dean Saunders found out that I do an impression of him, because Dean's always like, when I played, you had John Hartson, Ian Rush, Mark Hughes, Craig Bellamy, Malcolm Allen, and I was better than all of those. Because I was brilliant, and the way Dean always is, sort of, you know, selling himself. And somebody said to him, Dean, do you know Dan's does a really good impression of you? And his response was like that. I said, what, he scored 25 goals a season for 5 years in a row? Okay, that's a good comeback. That's a really good comeback. I don't think I've ever done anybody's impression to their face. I don't think that would have been very nice.
No.
So I kind of, steered clear of that. Respect, really, for the people I was doing. But, Dean Saunders had a very funny comeback.
Yeah, he's very very quick-witted, isn't he? Very sharp.
Oh, sharp as a tack. Yeah, he doesn't miss anything.
So what's planned for you? What have you got? What's your next steps?
You're on a book. I have written a book. Which may or may not get taken up by a publisher. And it's a book just about my radio time. I have also started writing stuff about everything that led up my band.
I was going to say, how do you even serialise as from music?
Just do it chronological. I don't think that's the way I've written this book about radio. I've just done it purely chronologically. That's the way it worked for me. From 1998 through to the present day.
And there's no car that you'd like at the moment that you're going to dedicate a couple of packs to?
I haven't put a very unsubtle request in for I should have done that. You made me think.
So. 3 litre,
exactly.
XC70 Volvo.
Exactly, yeah, I've left it too late there. Book is written. Whether that comes to light, it's not down to me. I'd like to record another solo album, because I've got three solo albums that have come out in the last
listened to them earlier.
10 to 11 years. Prove You Wrong was 2013, Second Time Around was 2015, and Rule of Three was 2 years ago. And I do have songs that I've written in the same sort of classic rock vein that I love. So I'd like to get around to recording those and get another album made. Even though the album, as a concept, seems less and less importance of the music buying public.
Yeah, it's you know just, what? I was going to ask you that. How do you find the dynamic around digital now? And
well, it's I mean, you know, Spotify and Apple Music royalty rates are what they are. They're an absolute disgrace. I'm not as reliant on those as you can imagine because of the work that I do. But if I was an artist, you know, that was my life, and I was relying on streaming rates from these rip-off companies, it would be, I wouldn't be able to buy groceries. It's just, you know,
it's pennies in the pound, isn't it?
Unfortunately, we're to this point where, you know, and people don't understand why concert tickets are so expensive. Well, work it backwards. You've got to a point where you want all the music that your favourite band or artist records practically for nothing. Where are they going to make their money, an artist or a band? It's through touring and through merchandise. Merchandise is now being cut off by venues who want a 25% cut of anything a band sells on its merchandise. So that revenue stream is being chopped off to a degree. And that's why concert tickets are so expensive, and that's why I don't agree with dynamic pricing at all. I think it's a disgusting practice. But that's why it's happening. Because these bands, these artists, are getting greedy. Greedy to the extent that the only way they can generate revenue, the make up for the shortfall with a lack of royalty rates from their music sales, they still get a fee from when it's played on the radio, but not everybody gets played on the radio.
I think the Oasis thing was a bit of pill to swallow more so, wasn't it? Because of who they are historically. And I know these divorces
are easy to pay for,
but...
Well, being on for 6 hours as well was a kind of a guilty kind of...
I mentioned earlier, I'm a Kiss fan, right? And Kiss reunited with their original lineup in 1996. And we were all so excited. And the tickets were £16-17 or something to go and see that show, the Kiss show.
And yeah, that is a show, isn't it?
It's a show. It's not people walking on with, you know, a pullover and a, you know, pair of slacks and sitting on a bar stool and plucking on a E string. This is
an experience,
absolutely, a live experience. You know, great music as well, you know, it's not just about the show, it's everything, the whole package. So that was an era where, you know, the concert ticket wasn't a ridiculous expense. But the reason it is now a ridiculous expense is because Radiohead released an album and said, pay what you want for it. U2 had an album released free through Apple Music that was downloaded to your phone, whether you wanted it or not.
Interesting fact there. My business partner is the only person in the world I think that's still got that album on his phone.
It's probably still lurking on mine somewhere, but
I think it's the only album he's got in there.
Right.
He's not a big music fan.
But that's the, you know, people became conditioned to the idea that music doesn't have to be worth anything. You can watch the video on YouTube, you can stream it on Spotify, and the artist gets 0.001p royalty.
So what was an artist getting when it was $3.99 for a CD single?
Well, that depends on the record deal that they signed with the record company. You know, it would still wouldn't be huge, but it'd be a downside more than what they're getting now. The other problem you had was in the 90s, you had artists like Mariah Carey and Robbie Williams signing these huge contracts with major record companies. Huge. And, of course, they kept all the money, and the money wasn't more evenly distributed,
right,
you know, to up-and-coming artists. And the record companies didn't see the streaming thing coming until it was too late. There was the Napster thing. Napster was the first sort of file-sharing thing that ever came out. Metallica were the band that tried to stop it and said that we can see where this is going. Metallica were almost made as pariahs for doing what they did, and saying, you have to stop this because we can see what happens in the future and how royalty rates get diminished. And it's only now that Metallica are getting, but actually they were right. You know, because Lars Ulrich can be seen as a bit of a figure of fun, the Metallica drummer, you know. Mm. But he and his bandmates were right. Napster and file sharing was a logical extension Do you remember those adverts you used to get in your vinyl records? Home taping is killing music and it's illegal. There was a skull and a crossbones in a cassette thing. I mean, we used to take
the piracy on the beginning of
And we
you wouldn't steal a car.
Yeah. So you don't steal a movie or And somebody even told me, even if you bought a vinyl album and taped it for the car, that was illegal. So even if you just had a cassette of an album you loved and you didn't have a vinyl record player in your car, no, you're supposed to buy the cassette version. Don't you just make your own copy of it and play it in your car? That's illegal. I don't know whether that's true, but that's what I was led to believe. So it was already there, but it wasn't as proliferated as much as it became with the file share, because it was so much easier to file share.
Right. I think we can... It's time for us to let you go. Talk to you all day, honestly. Thank you ever so much for your time today.
Yeah. Thank you, guys. It's been an absolute pleasure. It's lovely being here. Lovely seeing you guys.
Yeah.
And thank you for taking an interest in a boring old Barnby Brummie.
Thank you. Cheers, mate.